Joseph Menashe and Ephraim. And so when they say that they'll have the 12 tribes, Todaraba, thank you very much, Nicola. Reg, I want, except, Nicola, don't go. Everybody a round of applause and I'll explain to you why. Nicola is going to do something very good. You know, I really made copy here of my lectures because the lectures are already, I just summarized headlines, but it's a lot of trees in our forest. So what we're going to do is, Nicola, who knows more than we do, I know the Bible, she knows computers and all this, so she's going to put it on the site so you can listen to it and you can read it. Never mind the list. Todaraba, thank you. But obviously it will be only next week when I send you all the material. When you see all the, thank you, and when you see all the spelling mistakes and the grammar mistakes, please. These lights must come off. Why must they come off? You're in your eyes. Okay, they go. Okay, no wrinkles. Okay, names of God.
We are not allowed to pronounce his name. You remember? A boy named Sue, the great escape or something. We cannot have power over God, etc. So, and his name is so unusual, and it's YHV or WH. So different languages use the different, if it's V or W or whatever. And can you see, so some languages, I offend Utah, but because it's a German spelling, you will not use Utah. If it will be English, it will go with this. But because from the German spelling, so different language spell the name of Yahweh or Jehovah. Can you see where Jehovah Witness come from?
Yeah.
So it's actually we appropriate it. When we see this, when I see these four letters in the Bible, surely I have to say something, isn't it? So the custom is to say Adonai. Adonai means the master of all masters. And that's why in English translated as the Lord. You see, so it's very clear where it comes from. But because Adonai, and they put the vowel to remind people, I'll show you how tomorrow in the lecture about how to put vowels. So what happens is, because it's Adonai, think about it, if you add the vowel A to Ya, or Nai, Yehovah, Jehovah, that's where it comes from. They took the vowels in Hebrew to the English letters. What? No, no. However, there is an issue that everything in Hebrew, the verbs and adjectives, have. So when you see the word like this, there is obviously not, but if it's used in past tense or something, yes, and you hear the many. I give a course at UCT, it's called gender and sexuality, and that's one of the issues that women many times spill out because God is in a many. And in I went to a lecture in Colombia 1 year, and I say, being from the province, the little province of Quetta, I say, God says, or he says, and you have to see the student, they go, no, the whole lecture. So it was a very quick learning process for me. I did not dare say he or something, it was God says, God's, the divine, the God, but not anything to do with gender. Today it's a fine lecture, and we go through it, and then you can go home and start collecting your tents and your sleeping bag, because I went through the lecture of tomorrow. It's a big lecture that pulls everything together. It's magnificent, but it's going to be so. I'm going to start on time, and we will finish it. Boom, after not shorter than an hour. So I apologize, and if somebody will have to leave, you'll. But I will not go overboard. But there is certain very important things that I don't want to give up. It's magnificent, and with your knowledge of all the 4 days, the fifth day tomorrow will be pulling it together. Now, why there is so much genealogy in the Bible? Because I told you the most important, and I cannot emphasize how proud I am that in a society which we talk about 4,000 years ago, it's all record of 4,000 years ago, they were strict about
about incest and the things that we study in medicine, you know, if you marry your close your brother or you have a baby with too close for comfort, then the children are not right. And it was to keep the purity and the genealogy. So it's important to know who is the child of whom. My husband, he doesn't like to, that's a love letter, thank you. My husband doesn't like to read the Bible. He says it's French book. I say, why? He say, baguette. Everything is he baguette, she baguette. Everybody baguette. He said to me, you read it and tell me. So I read it and tell him. So there is no... there is a question why certain books like Enoch did not go into the Bible. I don't know. Why the book of Yashar didn't go? Why the book of the prophetess, a woman, Huldah, that was so important, didn't go into the Bible? We don't know. Maccabeans, for example, I know because it was just too late. So when you find the book of Maccabeans, there are four of them. Maccabean 1, 2, 3. Then I know because it missed the deadline. But otherwise, many times we don't know. And today you'll know certain things. We'll talk about biases or something. There is a very cute question about Esther, the book of Esther. Why there is so many names, first of all? But the most important is saying, why there are so funny names? Well, there are Persian names. And Persian names in Bigtha, Beresh, Achashverosh. Achashverosh is the king. The king Achashverosh. In English, you call him Achashverosh. Okay. And come to my Hebrew class, you know how to really pronounce it. But I'm sure that in fact, the Persian is a slightly different name. There is a chapter towards the end where they put together all the sons of Haman, the evil character, and to get to this chapter is very difficult. We have it always reading aloud. It's called the scroll in Purim holiday, and always people struggle with this. So, now, how are you today? Are you ready? You can see I have fun in the evening when I quickly put things together. Today we are in lecture 4 and it's story versus history. First of all, did you notice the word history? What is very clear about this? It's his story. It's never her story. And this is called hermeneutics of suspicions. And I have a course that I lecture in Peter Marisburg about hermeneutics of suspicions. I have to go there to the university because they develop now a course on gender and the Bible, and it's about reading with caution. Read carefully, because when we read also the biases of the writer, the biases of the editors, the biases of the redactors, what they threw away and what they kept, etc. So it's, but what I mean, the history is, let's say, is the reality, whereas the story, it's a narrative. Did it really happen as he described? The lecture distinguished between what happened and how it is told, or what is the narrative. You know, it came to me very strong. Sometimes the best idea comes to you, boom, when you drive or something. For me, the idea that is, depending how you tell it, came, my mom died. I think people that were here the first summer school, you remember, we had a memorial to her together. It was many years ago. And we went, and Jewish people sit for 7 days, locked in the house, and you remember the person, whoever comes to give respect, you have a chance to talk. So we heard stories that other people knew, my mother from another aspect, and I could not believe it was my mother. It is amazing. And you think it's only strangers or other people that knew and knew you? No. We are four girls. Do you know that me and my sisters, we see our moms totally different? And I'm talking about growing up in the same household, in the same years, in the same... So it's very much depend. It depends who is telling the story. There are two sides to every story, and there is something very interesting. In the most recent research, shows that there is what's called the 140% effect. Even when we agree on the fact that each individual sees things from his or her own point of view, each is sure of their bigger contribution. I'm a family counselor, and people come to me and they say, oh, we are very happy. I say, Now that is a very interesting, isn't it? Because then already it's called the self-centered bias in a way. Remember the 140, next time when you'll ask your partner and how much you contributed. Okay.
Please don't ask, you're absolutely wrong. You want to marry Schneiss?
Everyone in the second year, how beautiful I
am. He's lying. He's lying to his teeth. But it's very good for the marriage. Ahab and Jezebel were a couple. He was the king of Israel. You remember the northern kingdom? It's not in the south, in Judea. So he's not from the Davidic dynasty. He's from the north. Now, he was in the 7th century, and he ruled in these years, 20 solid years. He was the son of Omri. Omri is his father who started the dynasty. And funnily enough, he was so bad, according to the scribes, that he did not believe in God, because he married Jezebel. In Hebrew, it's Izebel. Izebel is like a, by now, it's like a mount of rubbish, you know. And she was a Sidonite princess. He married her maybe for purposes of allies, you know, to make the countries a good allies. But she was a very powerful woman. She was no pushover. And we'll see about them just now. What you remember, I alluded to it yesterday when I say that when he wanted a field, the vineyard of the neighbor, and he said, oh, I really want the vineyard of Naboth for my garden, vegetable garden. And she said, take it, don't be funny, because in Sidon, the kings did not have to adhere to the law. And he said, no, we can't. In Israel, you do have to follow the law. So she just had a court case. She pretended, she put two false witnesses. They said that he cursed the god or the king, and they put him to death. So like this, the vineyard became free. Anyway, the arch enemy was Elijah. It's not surprising, because Elijah was the prophet, the man of God. And because Ahab was influenced by Jezebel, he had the idols of the Baal. Baal was a very influential idol in the north. But now what I want to tell you is like this. Elijah, a very strong man, people listen to him, yeah? Jezebel, a very strong woman, it says that she kept 200 priests of the Baal on her dinner table. I mean, when I have to cook for egg, I already schmitz it, and that's people listened to him when she gave order, she ruled the country. Are you with me? He was a very zealous towards God, isn't it? She was very zealous to her God. You see what happened here? One day I took them and I showed my students on the table, they are a mirror image of each other. So why? Her name is an island full of rubbish, Jezebel, while he is considered Eliyahu, means Eli, my God, is Jehovah, Eliyahu. Are you with me on this? It's a very interesting. So why she is like this and he is like that? Because the hand that hold the pen rule the world. Are you with me? Okay, so now I have a few more details that I wanted to show you about Ahab. By the way, do you remember the book or the movie Moby Dick? How was the captain called? Why? Because, funny enough, because he went after things with craziness. He was crazy, and that's how they obviously used this. In Kings, it says that he married her, he built altars, there was great famine in the land, there was a battle between Eliyahu and Ahab and Jezebel, and war between Adad, the Aramean, Ben Adad, and then there's a story of Naboth vineyard. I'll tell you in a minute about the Hebrew. Are you with me on this? But what I wanted to show you, that my question, I'll come back to this in a minute, my question
is, can you see Ahab in the Bible? He's evil, he's ruled by his wife, he's a wimp, okay? The only positive detail is repentance. Do you know that when they come to him and they say, you will die? Because he said, why? He said, you didn't follow God. And he tore his clothes and he said, was he that bad? And they say, yes. And he repent totally. He put ashes on his head. They reversed, God reversed the lot. And he did not die only in his sin. And the dynasty did not die with him. And they didn't go into exile. Why? On the whole, he was not a believer. So who wrote, edited, and canonized the Bible? It's very clearly, it was believers of God. The main theme of the Bible is believing in God. Because he was not, then he's portrayed as he is. Are you with me? My question is, and I think I wrote it, otherwise I'm... Rega? No? Okay. I'll go, Rega, for just a second. You'll have to excuse me. What happened is, my question is, if there will be the Sidonite scribes would have written the Bible, if they would hold the pen, who would be the good one? And who would be the bad one? Because I showed you, they are mirror image of each other. It's an interesting, isn't it? Bearing always, this story is so clear. Bear in mind who writes, and then you know why. Here there is two, can you see my arrow? Yes. Here, Al Italel Choger Ki Mefateach. It's a wonderful idiom that I wish you'd take it with you from here, this course, because it's an idiom that goes with me, it's in the story, that goes with me all my life. Al Italel is don't boast. May the Choger is the soldier that put Chagua, that put gear on him. And the same way, the one that put the belt and the, basically the gun on him, the one that goes to the battle, don't let him boast like the one that come back. In other words, don't boast before the thing happens. When you come back from the battle and you say you want it, that's fine. Then I'm with you. But don't say I'm going to the battle and I'm going to win and I'm going to this. So, I tell forget to prepare. Don't boast and don't before you actually manage to make it. And another idiom that goes into the Hebrew, into the language is Haratzachta v'gam yarashta. You murder and you also inherit. It's when you benefit from your crime. And this is unheard of. This is so abhorrent, isn't it? That somebody is doing something and then benefit from it. Now he killed Naboth and he benefits from the vineyard. This is an... So these two idioms infiltrate into the language and I use it a lot and it's such a... And it's both of them from Ahab's story. So, as we say, Ahab is in the Bible look like a wimp, really. There is nothing about his greatness or anything. However, I studied these years and now I'm corroborating a lot of the information from the Bible with archaeology and I found that Ahab was one of the mightiest kings in the Fertile Crescent. He had horses, he had chariots, he was a consultative ruler. He went in allies with the neighbors. He is the one that ran the show, but he consulted with others. Where is it in the Bible? It's not. He was a mighty king. What alerted me is that I found the Kirk, or what we called the Karkar monolith, in the stone here. Can you see this? It's written that how many soldiers went to fight and something, it's one of the battles. And he put together Elias, Ahab, it says. And out of the 4,000 chariots, 2,000 were Ahab's chariots. We talk about five kings together. He was the biggest. He was the one that put together. That's the one. He put aside local difference in order to form an alliance or something. So the question, who would have been written, how the story would have been written, if it would be by others. Are you with me on this? So if we got this point, then let's see. What I wanted to make a point is also, you don't need to lie. You only need to emphasize certain aspects in order to instill prejudice. And one
Judges 19. What happened is the following. Who wrote many of the books and who rewrote and edited a big chunk of the Bible? Well, David's scribes. According to what the glimpse that you look in the beginning of the book of Samuel, the people liked King Saul. He was the first king. He did not know how to behave as a king. He did not build a palace because he didn't know you need a palace. He was a leader, but he was a small and local leader. He didn't have gravity. But David wanted to put him down. How can you put down somebody? So the point is, if we will pull down his tribe, if we pull down the people around his family, then by implication, Saul is nobody. So, lo and behold, there is Judges chapter 9, it's towards the end of the book of Judges, a bizarre story about the Ephraimite, a person from the tribe of Ephraim, who goes with the concubine, and it's a long and short, the murder, it's a rape, gang rape of his concubine, and the whole tribe of, because it happened in the tribe of Benjamin, the whole country shunned away the tribe of Benjamin, and they said they would never marry into them, etc., etc. They put them, and basically, Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, was to be finished, to be exterminated, out of it, and to die away, to disappear. And when they realized, after they put the curse on the tribe of Benjamin, they realized, you can't do this. It's a tribe in Israel. So there is a very cute story about, they say, okay, what do we do? On a certain day, the ladies from Benjamin go to the vineyard or something, and they came, men from the other parts of Israel, came and they kidnapped them. And they love them, and they marry them, and they have babies, and of course the babies go under the tribe of Benjamin. So they averted their own curse, but why I'm telling you, because the tribe of Benjamin got bad press. And especially the city of the Gibeah. That's where the gang rape and the murder happened. Now where do you think Saul come from? The tribe of Benjamin from Gibeah. How much of it is true exactly and how much is manipulation by the scribes of David, can you see, in order to put the dynasty of Saul down, we do not know. So, when the hand of the hand meaning the scribes, and the head, the king who employed them, do not see eye to eye. It can also happen. Here, maybe, they got an order, the scribes, to put down Benjamin, or at least to keep him down as it was. But what happened now, the scribes want to say something about David. They do not agree with David. But you can't write against your king. You can't write against your boss. I want to see how long you keep your job when you write against your boss. So what happened is, there is an unbelievable chapter in the Bible, in 2 Samuel 11, and it's the chapter of Uriah. You remember Uriah is the husband of Bathsheba, and Uriah is actually not Hebrew, but he is from the tribes that live around Israel, and he goes to war supporting David. And when David was with all the soldiers in the field, that's fine, but then he became tired, and since he's the king, he went back home, and since he's the king, he has a nice roof, and since he has a good eyesight, he sees Bathsheba, and since he has a nice body, he calls the king, and the rest is history. Anyway, when she sent him a message that he's pregnant, he thinks, oh my goodness me, everybody knows their husband is in the war. It's not good. So what does he do? He sent a message for the Yoab ben Zuriah, Yoab the chief of staff, to send Uriah back home. And he hopes that the soldier, when he comes home, where he goes the first place, to have a bath, and then Mary is going to visit his wife. Because they, for months, they are in the fields away from the women. But Uriah does not go home. So now the ploy is kaput. So he calls him and he says to him, why don't you go home after so many months there in the field? And Uriah, the scribes put the speech of Uriah. What the scribes were there in the room? They were not there in the room. But what they put in the mouth of Uriah is one of the biggest criticisms. It's called the king in an ironic picture, situation. Uriah said to the king the following, all the officers of Israel, and my friends and my soldiers, are sitting in the field, sleeping basically on the ground, and eating nothing else. And I will go and make love to my wife? No, that's not ethical. What does the writer describe telling us? He didn't even go for his loyal wife, for the lawful wife. They dined with his wife, totally unlawful, unethical, etc. There is unbelievable irony in the story. And like I said, the scribes were not in the room. So how do they know? Well, they are scribes. They put the word in his mouth. Please go and have a look at this chapter and you see the irony, how they wanted. Everybody knew by that time what happened there. By the way, do you know that this child from this liaison died? It's not Solomon. Because this is called Mamzer. This is a child from adultery. That is not... A child out of wedlock is okay. It's not a bastard. But a child out of adultery, this is not okay. And so this child died. God let him go. Okay. Now, because we are talking about literature, I wanted to tell you that there is a big, big difference in the Bible between chapters that you read in prose and chapters that you read in poetry. Why? Poetry, in a minute I'll show you where there are only two cases in the Bible which you see the same story in poetry and in prose. So you can compare the character, how it is told in the poetic side and how it's. But in general, first I would like to tell you, poetry is emotional. Why? Because it's not the subjective voice. It's a voice of a particular person at a particular time. And everybody has the right in the world to say how they feel. So therefore, there is burst of happiness. The Psalms are beautiful because David writes in abundance about love. There is a lot of emotion, but only in the poetry side. The prose is objective. I'll show you the nice tricks, how they let you know what they think. But you have to be very attentive to the text. You can't just, it's not dished out. In poetry, it's dished out. By the way, which one are these two chapters? Of course, you know that this is the Song of the Red Sea. This is the story, how they crossed the Red Sea. And this is the song that Miriam led the people. And Judges 4 is the story of Deborah, how she's coming down from the mountain with Barak, and they conquer Sisra, there is something, and the Judges 5 is the poem that she's singing, and she let them have her opinion. Now, poetry reflects, like I say, emotion. Miriam, for example, in Exodus 15, Miriam and the people, of course, they mock the nation. Oh, you fearful bunch. Oh, you funny people. God, she described God, like somebody asked, you remember the question, why God looks so zealous, powerful, warrior? Because that's how they wanted him to be in this case, for example, of the war. So in the poem she said, God is breathing fire from his nostrils. Almost like a dragon. There's a picture of power. And she said, and the nations shiver. And she goes on and on, repeating which nation was more afraid, etc. It's very emotional. The Deborah in Hebrew, she also let them have it, what she thinks. And she led a war against Yabin,
the Galilee, it's a little town that was not Jewish, and his chief of staff was Sisera. And the neighbor, he bugged the neighbors, which was one of the tribes of Israel. So Deborah sent a message. They came to her. She was the prophetess. And they went to her and asked her, can you help us? So she sent a message to all the tribes, please come and help us. And then they didn't come, only very few. And she let them help, the other tribes that didn't come. And with Reuven is the best, because she said, and Reuven was so busy discussing it, if to come or not to come. You always have a picture of committee meetings, you know. And have a look, but it will not appear in a pause, because a pause would state they did not come, let's say. They did not join. But in the poetry, you see that it was not acceptable, and she discarded. So, the prose, how do we know what happened with the prose? There is no adjectives, for example, unless it occurs for something else. For example, we know that Sarah was pretty. So you think, oh, Tilly is funny. She said there's no adjective. It says she was pretty. But the next story is that Pharaoh, once and later the king of Grab, they not kidnapped her, but they took her into the harem. It says that Joseph was a strapping young man. But the next sentence is that Potiphar's wife tried to convince him to have a nice liaison with him. He refused, funny enough. For the sex abuse in reverse. Yeah. So, but can you see? When you read it, you think, oh, is she funny? She told us no adjective. Watch it. Because it is going to be followed something about this. It brought about early. What else? The Bible does not pass judgment. And I will give you an example in a minute. I think it's on the computer, so I'll not talk in detail. It doesn't express opinion, not directly. You see, it can tell you a story of Benjamin, and that's how horrible the city of Gibeah and the Benjaminites. It hopes that you will pick it up, what they want from you. So it's not dishing it out very clearly. So, how can you describe something without adjective? What happened is, you build, for example, an expectation, and then, if you meet expectations, then you know, that's fine. And if you don't meet expectations, then you think, why? And I think the Bible is full of it, but I thought it would be nice for you, because if you write one reference, Genesis 24, it will be sufficient for you to see how wonderful. In two cases, it doesn't say that Rebecca was kind, but it says that Eliezer was the messenger from Abraham. He came to look for a wife for Isaac. It was the old Shidet, you know, the old matchmaking agency. So he went far away to Mesopotamia to find a wife. So he said to God, do me a favor, I'll ask the woman so-and-so. It's almost like a code, like in James Bond. I will say so-and-so, and if the woman says so-and-so, then I know that's the right wife. It's interesting. By the way, he said the code, and she deviates from the code again. And it passes it to no end, and I read it again and again. And I think it leads, because in Judaism there is divorce. And I think it almost like it leaves you the opportunity. It's almost perfect, but just in case they would have had divorce, at least you know it's not absolutely God's decree. But what Eliezer said to Rebecca, he see her, a young lady, and he said to her, will you lower your pitcher and let me have some drinks? So she said, now listen carefully, she said, I will give you and your camels. It's not finished. You already think, wow, she's a nice girl, because you know camels can drink, huh? They go for 2 weeks without, and then, boy, they... But listen to stage number 3. She said, I'll give you camels until they are... until they satisfy with the drinking. So the woman was ready to run down to the well, you know, the spring of the Lord, and to come up and to
fall down and come up. Also, well, not just for him, what he expects, as a, an older man, to give him the respect, but she was kind enough to animals as well, and she was not saving of her energy. And Eliezer Wisdom, how do you know that he was wise? He was the first politician in the world. He, Abraham said, go to my country and find for me a wife for Isaac, my son. Now, how many sons does he have? Exactly. So how many can inherit? Two. And he has to go to Mesopotamia or something. When Eliezer comes to the house of Rebecca, listen to how he's saying it. He says, Abraham sent me to his family, in other words, to his family in Mesopotamia. Now, he didn't really lie, did he? But what does he do? He makes them the commitment. He pushed for the commitment. It's like somebody calling for donation. Hello, he doesn't know your name, he doesn't know anything. Are you sorry, so number? Yes. Can you give us money? No. If they come and say, hello, John? Is it John? Yeah? How are you prepared to give us some money? Now you feel like, I can't not give the money. They know my name, they tell me. Read the chapter. Look how clever. He pushed for commitment. Now they feel obliged to help him. Also, he doesn't, when he say, he doesn't say that Abraham has another child in case they will be afraid that the girl now will not inherit. Because he has to take this girl to far away land. So he say, and Abraham, my master, a rich man, he has everything. And he has this son in all this, son in old age. In other words, he's not going to make another one. They don't know that he has other children that may inherit. They know that there is a commitment here. He sent to them. And there is a good future for the young lady. So it's an interesting. He is so clever. Read chapter 24 and you are going to have a very good time seeing how he drop a word and he adds a word. And what about not passing judgment? I told you that I prepared it. It's Jacob disregard for birth order. It's not right. Guys, if the law says that the firstborn has to inherit, how do you think? And you know very well how the brothers felt when Joseph got the different color coat, isn't it? We know it very clearly. We shouldn't do it because it will cause a lot of grief in the family. And yet, in the Bible, you do not blink an eyelid. There is no criticism about this. It's stating a fact. And it says, he was his favorite. What can you do? Now, when you read it as a child, I was number two, the sandwich at home, you know. You say which nobody loved them, you know. Nobody loved me. And they weren't ready to kill Joseph. So when I was little and I read it, I was siding with the brothers. Let him have it. And I was very close with Jacob. And then you grow older and you have children of your own. And you know that today you love him a little more, tomorrow you love her a little more. And then you love this one a little more. You feel closer, not love, that's not the right word. But if you admit to yourself in your heart, the different time you feel closer to different children in your family. The Bible doesn't pass judgment. It lets us read it. That's why we read it at different ages, at different stages in our life. That's why the Bible survived, while Homer, we have to read it in a classic department that you sit in. People don't read it out of their love. And the Bible is the most strange book, because you read and you read at different times of your life, and there's not passing judgment. He's doing the same mistake later. A mistake by the law when he has Menashe and Ephraim. And Joseph brings them and he's already old and he can hardly see. And he put his hand, the right hand, which is supposed to be the blessing. He put the right hand on Ephraim, the young one. And Joseph, he knows how much he suffered from the preferential treatment. And he knows you should be fair. And he say, Daddy, you made a mistake. And he take his hand and he move it. The right hand. and must go on the Menashe.
And Jacob said, I know what I'm doing. The Bible doesn't criticize us for this. It just stated.
So it's a very interesting. You can read into it, you can see prophecies in it, you can see. But the idea is that, like I say, you read it at a different stage of your life, you see it differently. How does then the Bible transmit a message if it doesn't pass judgment? We have hints. This is why we have to study and keep studying it in order to unearth or discover the message. It is incumbent upon us to try and find these hints by reading and rereading carefully and attentively. In other words, and that's why you come to summer school.
So it's not an American life for my hope. But it is wonderful because when you come and you learn, and by the way, do you know in Judaism you're not allowed to study alone? Because when you study alone, you get on some funny track and you make a mistake and you go far. And suddenly, you know, when you are enjoying it, you realize you actually wanted to go to the other cake. In Judaism, they say that the Shekhinah, God's spirit, is sitting on the shoulder, on the place between the two shoulders of the students. So only if you study with somebody else, the Shekhinah, God's spirit, is with you. Why? Because if you say something and you really get into Johannesburg, they say to you, oh, you are on the wrong way, you are on the N1 and not the N2. So it's very important to have constant feedback. And that's why we have to study this. But we have to try and unearth the hints. How can we find hints? There is a careful reading. And yesterday I mentioned also one of the most fantastic rules that I follow so religiously is Hermann Gunkel. You remember I said yesterday the German idiom, sitzen leben. Sit yourself in their situation. Don't sit yourself in 2012 at UCT. Not in your home, not in Fishuk or something. You have to think, how was it feeling? How did it feel to be there? And there is many examples. I'm trying to be very careful and on time. So, okay. Intertextuality. Intertextuality is the best part of the Bible. I love it because it keeps me going. Intertextuality is when you read a text and you say, wait a second. Something in it reminds me something else. And you go and you look for similar stories, and I'll give you a clue how to look for it. It's certain keywords or something appear. And why do you have to have the intertextuality? Because, like this, if it agrees, it adds that, isn't it? If it disagrees, the two texts are in tension with each other, it makes you think. Now, what better is this? It makes you ponder, it makes you think, it's evaluating things and all this, and it adds more and more details. We'll start by the simple one, the careful reading. Look at something that on the surface, the cliche or the thing we'll say, think about Moses and Miriam. Moses, what we are told is Moses is the leader, Miriam is the sister, she's not so important, you know. Okay. What we get from the side glimpse and from the little hints is that Miriam was a very important woman in the nation. When she got sick, the whole nation refused to move until she got better. Because sick people always they were removed from the camp in order not to, if it's contagious, to infect others. Exactly. Now, what happens is the whole Israel, thousands of people said they will not go until Miriam will get better. He said that when she died, the water stopped. The word Miriam is like Mayim without. Mayim is water. She was a fountain of life. She was the spiritual leader. She was not the political like Moses. She was not the judicial like Aaron, the priest. She was the spiritual leader that the people loved so much. But you only read it, you only get it when you read carefully, without prejudice, without preparation. If you read that everybody is mourning or everybody is, you think, how come a whole nation is this? Joseph and in Pharaoh Palace. That's a good example of sitting leaven. Now, can you imagine Joseph? He was arrogant as a child, but he was blamed for nothing and he was in jail for many years. And then, so he learned to shut up. He knew now, he learned sometimes to say what not palace of Pharaoh, and he decides on Pharaoh's dream. And then Pharaoh says, so who will help me in this huge task? Now, if Joseph would have been 17 years old, what he would say? Me, because you remember how he was an arrogant young man. He kept a tittle tale on his brothers. Read chapter 37. He was a tittle tale. He went to his father and said, they do this, they don't do this. And he would not have shut up. He would say, but his life taught him as something else. Also, think, sit in heaven, sit yourself in Pharaoh's court. Do you think that Pharaoh said by himself? Of course, there was the pictures and archaeological things show us all the advisors and the very important viziers or whatever it was at the time called, Chachamim, the clever. Do you think that Joseph knew not to say anything, me, when all of them are going, he's going to be stabbed 2 minutes later, we know from Shakespeare, they don't like you, they get you. Now, Joseph was already in jail many years and he learned to shut up. He said, I don't know. I actually don't know who will help you. Maybe you should ask God. And of course, God tells Pharaoh, use him. But the idea is, sit yourself in the palace. Don't sit in a hall, lecture hall. It's amazing. And then you realize exactly why Joseph say what he say and why he shuts up. I told you that there is the modern and important method of reading. It's called hermeneutic. Hermeneutic, it means commentary and learning the Bible. Usually hermeneutic goes for religious text. And it's called hermeneutic of suspicion. When you read something, please read it with suspicion. Because, like you heard until now, you know who held the pen, you know that it advises, you know that they try to push a point, you know that they are the believers, so if somebody is out of line, etc. And one of the most interesting, cute things is, you know that Michal, the daughter of Saul, she was David's wife. He wanted to secure the kingship. So he said he wants to marry her because like this, he married a princess and he ensured that all the followers of Saul will follow him now. So he married her. She loves him to bits. She's ready to risk her life for him. So she is a fantastic woman. I really like Michal. She suffers. And there is a story that he leaves her and he goes. Eventually he married other women. And when he comes back and he becomes the king of Jerusalem and the king of all the nations, he said, by the way, where is Michal? I want her here. Did he say he missed her? No. Did he say he loved her? No. Why did he want her there? He wanted there because he wanted to secure again all the people that were Saul's followers, all the Benjaminites and everybody. So he brought her back. And he kept her in the palace. He did not go and make love to her. There is a reason, maybe next year when we learn, maybe sex in the, not sex in the city, sex in the Bible. I'll tell you why he didn't come near her anymore. They did not make love anymore. And she never had children, of course. As I think that you know, you are in the age to know that if you don't make love, you're underpaid. So it's very clear why she didn't have babies. But after she had an argument with David, and she's quite cheeky, she said to him, look at you. Look how you behave and you sweat him. She let him have it. She was very angry. And the sentence that followed says, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, it doesn't say Michal, the wife of David, isn't it? Look at that, already they're hinting to you. They disassociate them. And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child until the day of her death. I know she had no child. If you don't have sex, you can't have children. But why do they put it right after the sentence that she argued and she spoke not nicely to King David? It's a warning to all of us ladies. Just like his new husband. You never came to have babies.
You think I'm funny, but you look in your Bible and it hurts you. It actually hurts you as a woman to read it and you say, it is so clear, unrelated. But it is so clear there for the uninitiated, for the young ladies, listen to your husband, Adam. Intertextuality can be also in tight scenes.
Tight scene is like meeting on the well. If you have a scene that repeating, then you can compare them. Rachel met Jacob on the well. They loved each other from the minute they met until they died. Wonderful. Then you read that Isaac doesn't meet Rebecca on the well. It was a matchmaking. So you think, oh, maybe I'm led to believe that it was never such a great marriage. You know, it was only a matchmaking. It wasn't that. Then you have the meeting of the on the well of Moses and his wife Zipporah, the Midianite princess. But it doesn't say anything about love. It says that they went home and the Jethro, Yitro, the Midianite princess, what do you mean a young man helped you and you didn't bring him home? Ah, okay, so they went to call him and then it says that Yitro married them. Can you think? Alone, you wouldn't read anything into it. But when you compare it to Rachel and Jacob, the last story, then you realize, oh, maybe there is not so much love. The attention in the meeting between Moses and Zipporah was justice, because he helped them, the ladies, the sisters, against the old shepherd that chased them away. And that is what they tell you. Never mind the love. Notice that wherever Moses goes, it's always about justice. So if you have a tight scene, a scene that's repeating, the difference between them will tell you what you want to know. It's amazing. There's also keywords. Excuse me, when I read a word that is not something unusual, I think, okay, let me go. How is unusual? Or it appears only a few times. Like the coat, the technicolor coat, it appears twice. One by Joseph, and one by she wears it, Tamar, the daughter of King David, who was raped by her mother. I urge you to put the two stories together, and you'll see, oh my goodness me. This is two families where the patriarch left control. They lost control of their family. These are patriarchs with a lot of siblings rivalry. Joseph and the brother, and here is the rape, and they kill each other. Read story next to the story, and you don't need any more commentary. You don't need any more adjectives. You have one story to compare to the other, which will give you all the clue in the world that you need. I find the story, there is a word Vayaham. Vayaham appears only twice in the Bible. Once in the Song of the Red Sea, we just saw in Exodus 15, and one in the story of Deborah. Suddenly I said, that's funny. This is the only part in the Bible that you have prose and poetry. So I thought, maybe I have to read it together, and I start reading, and I found the most wonderful. Vayaham, it means, and he made a big chaos. And then I found out that in the story of Exodus, it doesn't say exactly, it says that the chariot of Pharaoh came and they got stuck in the mud. You remember, because it was muddy from the sea, from the Red Sea, that opened. But it doesn't say anything what happened to the soldiers after this. And it says that the sea closed. Did they run away? Did something? So I went to the other part of the Bible, where this well, which is slightly, it's marked quite a little corrupt, it appeared again, and then I found that it says that when the Sisera tried to siege the mountain where Deborah was, Sisera was the army, and Deborah, you know, this, and God said to Deborah and Barak, wait, she said, can you go now? No, wait. Wait until the rain came. And then was a major flood. And then he said, now you can go. And the major flood, they ran down from the mountain. And all the strength of the enemy, they lost it because they came with chariots. Now the chariots got stuck in the mud. And the minute they got stuck in the mud, Dvorah and Barak chasing by foot, killed them, etc., etc. But it's not clear from the text. What happened there? How come suddenly they won? If you read one against the other, you will, this is the story of the chariot that got stuck in the mud. Oh, maybe their chariot got stuck in the mud, of course. And you read it together. I can't, there is more, but I cannot. Now, that obviously we scratched the surface, but time does not allow us to have more. Example, there is, okay, so now,
Shall we leave it? Tomorrow we are going to learn about the room. I just want to tell you,
okay, before I say anything, what I urge you is that when the priest or the rabbi or the imam or the sheikh, I'm talking about this tomorrow, tell you something, you say it's wonderful, but it's one person reading it. The point is always to read it with other people, to come without prejudice, to try to realize life is there. And the most important, what can you learn from this and apply to our life?